This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A few weeks ago, this story came across the wires. U.S. troops rushed to freeze their sperm before heading to Persian Gulf, fearful that powerful vaccines or exposure to biological weapons might affect their health. The troops were worried, of course, about coming down with a Gulf War illness. Thousands of troops who served in the 1991 Persian Gulf War got sick after they returned home with a variety of symptoms that doctors couldn't link to any particular disease. They called them Gulf War illnesses. And even though the fighting lasted for only a few months, Gulf War veterans were 2 to 3 times as likely to get sick as the troops who stayed home. Researchers still don't know the causes behind Gulf War illnesses, and over the years they've studied dozens of possible culprits, including nerve gas, pesticides, the anthrax vaccine, stress, and even dust and smoke. And if we don't know what caused Gulf War illnesses, how can we prevent another outbreak if our troops go to war with Iraq? And if more soldiers do get sick, is there any hope that we'll figure out what caused the symptoms or how to treat them? Well, this hour we'll be talking about what we know, what we don't know about Gulf War illnesses and how to prevent them, possibly a new research on preventions and treatments. So if you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Let me introduce my guests. Dr. Michael Kilpatrick is the Deputy Director of Deployment Health Support for the Department of Defense. They help to protect the health of troops deployed around the world. He joins us from our NPR studios in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm proud to be here.
Thank you. Also in Washington is Steve Robinson. He's a Gulf War veteran and the executive director of the National Gulf War Resource Center, an organization for Gulf War veterans. So welcome to Science Friday, Steve.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Also, Dr. Stephen Hunt is a physician and director of the Gulf War Veterans Clinic at the Department of Veterans Affairs at Puget Sound Healthcare System. And he joins us from member station KUOW in Seattle. Thank you for being with us, Dr. Hunt.
Thanks for the invitation, Ira. And I also want to extend to you the thanks from several Gulf War veterans in our support groups here for having this discussion today. They're very pleased that you're having it. I think it's very, very important.
Well,
so thanks from them as well.
Well, you're welcome. Let's start with you. You've seen hundreds of Gulf War veterans in your clinic over the years. Describe to us what it means when we talk about Gulf War illnesses.
When the veterans began returning from the Gulf, within a year or so, we began seeing veterans reporting a variety of health problems, the majority of which were routine expected types of health problems. 80% of the health problems of Gulf War veterans are not necessarily unusual and yet still important. Approximately 20% of the Gulf War veterans coming back, and this has been verified in a number of studies and in my clinical experience as well, have what we call medically unexplained symptoms. And these symptoms are severe and they're causing a great deal of difficulty for these veterans. Despite extensive workups, we can't necessarily find diagnoses for some of the symptoms. There's a lot of overlap in this issue of medically unexplained symptoms. We see it in non-veteran populations as well. And so we're trying to sort out which of these symptoms could be related to either toxic environmental exposures, psychological trauma and stress, and that's kind of what the research has been directed towards.
And describe, these symptoms are wide-ranging, aren't they?
Really, the symptoms involve pretty much every body system. It can be neurological symptoms, it can be skin symptoms, it can be cardiac GI symptoms, urinary tract symptoms. But the primary ones that seem to be most common are, as was mentioned earlier, fatigue, muscle and joint pain, and what they call cognitive difficulties, concentration difficulties, memory difficulties, and so on. Those are the three categories of symptoms that are most common.
Mm-hmm. It seems like neurological research is the hottest area of Gulf War illnesses, illness studies these days. Is there a growing sense that we could be looking for some kind of brain damage in Gulf War illness?
Well, we want to be sure we check out everything, and certainly some of the symptoms seem to be potentially neurologically based. We have a large number of studies looking at the brain and central nervous system functioning. Last year, there was a finding that there seemed to be a higher rate of ALS, or amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, among Gulf War veterans, and this is a devastating central nervous system disease, and this has triggered both a registry for ALS patients, and also research projects to try to figure out, is in fact ALS more common among Gulf War veterans? And if so, what could that be related to?
Dr. Kilpatrick, you represent the Department of Defense. What is the DOD stance on all of this?
Well, clearly, as Dr. Hunt has described, we recognize that Gulf War veterans coming back did have symptoms that occurred from either the time they were in the theater or shortly after returning, or in some cases up to years after coming back, that could not be described with a recognized medical diagnosis. And I think as the medical evaluation and doing the medical tests that routinely we do to try to diagnose symptoms, we're not able to identify a recognized illness. I think it's human nature to want to know, one, why am I ill, and if I have symptoms, what is this entity and what does it mean for my future health? And I think that's where the research program that the Department of Defense, Veterans Affairs, and Health and Human Services mounted several, probably 6-7 years ago, to try to understand these issues has been one that has looked at individual issues, at epidemiology, at known exposures that occurred in the Gulf. And certainly as we try to say, can we find a cause and effect relationship, we've not been able to be to a point where we could say this is definitive. I think that's one of the reasons the research needs to continue, and I think both the Department of Defense and Department of Veterans Affairs recognize that deployment-related medical problems are real. These are not imaginary issues, and certainly we need to make sure that we have established a research program to help us better understand what could be some of the causative agents for these symptoms that occur and how to better treat them and better diagnose them. And eventually then, what do we do during a person's time in the military help prevent them from occurring?
Steve Robinson, you're a veteran of the last Gulf War. Your group has said that the Army hasn't done enough to improve its protection of soldiers. What are they doing wrong?
Well, to be fair, they have done some things that that are going to protect soldiers, but specifically, I would like to address the things that I think aren't being addressed. Number one is that there's been some congressional hearings that aren't widely publicized. Christopher Shays has held hearings that discussed deficiencies in the chemical protective gear, in the chemical detectors, in the gas masks that soldiers of the next Gulf War would use. This hearing was conducted in October, and he received a briefing and an internal Army audit, which talked about the fact that, according to this audit, 62% of the gas masks and 90% of the chemical detectors we currently use were reported at that time of the audit to be defective. Additionally, there were reports of from the Government Accounting Office that talked about 250,000 defective chemical warfare suits somewhere lost in the Army inventory that the military couldn't account for. And finally, the last thing, and the one that's most troubling, and I hope we can get some answers on it today, is that as a result of the lessons learned from the Gulf War, Congress initiated a law called Public Law 105-85, Section 762 through 767. And what it says is that because we need to understand what soldiers are exposed to and whether or not they're healthy before they go, Congress wrote a law that said you will conduct pre-deployment, during deployment, and post-deployment screenings. These screenings will include a physical, a hands-on physical by a physician, and include the drawing of blood before and after the deployment. This blood would then be used to take a snapshot of you before you left and after you returned. We have the capability now, and I'm not a scientist, but we have the capability, as I understand it, by talking to scientists, to look at molecular changes in the blood down to down to a molecule and to see changes in cells. So this is the reason why Congress established the law, and specifically, of all the things that I've heard recently that are deficiencies, this is the one that bothers me the most, because it seems we've missed a golden opportunity to collect the baseline data.
You're saying that that blood has not been collected from the GIs, headed over there?
It's my understanding, and Dr. Kilpatrick will explain it, whether it is or is not happening. It's my understanding that what the department has done, instead of actually doing what the public law says, is that they are using HIV blood samples, which could be collected anywhere from 6 months to a year from the date of when a soldier deploys, And if when the soldier returns, he has an HIV sample, I don't know if they've established a protocol to take blood samples from veterans upon their return. Additionally, I've been in contact with National Guard organizations all over the United States. They report that this is, in fact, true. There are soldiers deployed, and many of them did not receive blood sample draws, but others have, and I think that's an individual initiative that those states took. The public law says everyone should have their blood drawn, and it's the simple reason as this. The Institute of Medicine just 3 weeks ago came out with its final report on pesticides and solvents used in the first Gulf War. And what they said was is that although some of these solvents and some of these pesticides can in fact cause illnesses, and either in combination, combining solvents and pesticides can cause illnesses, and we have evidence to show it, they couldn't link those illnesses and exposures to things that veterans complained about because there was no baseline data to connect. And that's why the public law was written, to connect the exposures with the illnesses. And the reason why this is significant and the reason why the public law was written is because when the veteran returns, he has to go to the Department of Veterans Affairs and show that an illness or an injury that he occurred during war is the reason why he's making a claim for treatment or compensation with the Department of Veterans Affairs. Now, to their credit, the Department of Veterans Affairs has instituted a policy in which returning National Guard soldiers will receive 2 years of free health care. But as soon as that 2 years is up, they then have to prove whatever happened to them in the war, it was due to an exposure. So this is why the drawing of blood and the baseline data is so important.
Dr. Kilpatrick?
Let me talk about the Department of Defense's Force Health Protection Program, because protecting the health of our men and women in uniform is a top priority of the Department of Defense Medical Department, whether they're deployed or whether they're at home. Protecting their health and the health of their family is that top priority. We began our Force Health Protection Program. It's basically built on three pillars. The first is to recruit and maintain a fit and healthy force. That starts with an entrance physical examination for every man and woman coming into the military to make sure they meet the rigorous requirements to be physically fit. We continue that with promoting health while they're on active duty with physical readiness training. We have periodic physical examinations. We have annual dental examinations. We have twice a year physical readiness testing. There is sort of an ensemble of medical intervention that goes on during a person's time in uniform. When it comes time to deploy, we have instituted, as an addition to that routine health care providing, a pre-deployment health assessment, which is questions asking about their health from their perception of their health. Do they have any medical issues since their last periodic physical examination that need to be addressed? We ask, essentially, have they sought any sort of mental health counseling in the last year prior to deployment? And then we ask about medications that they're taking. Clearly, all of that is an information that we depend on that soldier, sailor, airman, marine to answer in a truthful way. That survey instrument then is reviewed by a healthcare provider prior to their deployment to make sure that they in fact are fit and ready to deploy. There is a blood sample requirement prior to deployment, and if they have had an HIV sample drawn, a screen done in the last 12 months, that baseline sample does fulfill the requirement prior to their deployment.
All right. I have to take a break, so we'll come back and let you finish your statement. We'll come back, as I say, after this break and talk lots more about Gulf War sicknesses, illnesses, so stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about Gulf War illnesses with my guest, Michael Kilpatrick, Deputy Director of Deployment Health Support for the Department of Defense, Steve Robinson, a Gulf War veteran and Executive Director of the National Gulf War Resource Center, Stephen Hunt, a physician and Director of the Gulf War Veterans Clinic at the Department of Veterans Affairs Puget Sound Healthcare System in Seattle. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. When I left the break, Dr. Kilpatrick, you were saying then that this drawing of blood, the HIV blood, satisfies the law that Congress passed about drawing blood previous to deployment?
Right. The public law 105-85 that was passed in 1997 requires a medical examination to be done prior to and after deployment with drawing of blood and health assessment. And that law was written because of the concern following Desert Shield, Desert Storm, that we did not really have good data on baselining of individuals prior to going. We did not have good data on what were the exposures they experienced while deployed. And we did not have good medical data on their condition of their health when they return. I think the second pillar of forced self-protection I was talking about is to prevent disease and injury, and we do that during deployments with doing environmental surveillance prior to putting troops on the ground if possible, if troops are on the ground to do environmental surveillance, so where they are to make sure they're not in a toxic environment from toxic industrial chemicals or anything else. We certainly have instituted in the last couple months an electronic medical surveillance program where we can monitor the health care that they're receiving throughout the theater and know who's being seen for what kinds of problems. And then when they come home, as I said, we do the post-deployment health assessment, making sure that any medical issues or concerns they have are addressed at the time they return. And that then is really followed up by the post-deployment health clinical practice guideline. Whenever a person comes into sick call in the military or comes to a VA, because the post-deployment health clinical practice guideline was developed by both departments, they are asked, are your health concerns today, in your mind, perhaps related to a deployment? And if they are, there is a very specific medical approach to address that individual's health concerns. Mm-hmm. That whole program, we believe, really is consistent with what the intention of the law was, the way it was written, and we've spent the last week actually briefing this program mm-hmm. to the people on Capitol Hill. The Department of Defense did submit a report outlining that program in 1998. To Congress as to how we were responding to the requirements of the law.
All right, let me bring in another expert. Joining us by phone is Dr. Beatrice Gollum. She's a neuroscientist and the scientific director for the Department of Veterans Affairs Research Advisory Committee on Gulf War Illness. She's also an assistant professor of medicine at the University of California in San Diego. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Gollum.
Delighted to be here.
There are stories, recent stories in the media about, and I'll read you another headline like I did at the beginning. It says, recent studies investigating the effects of low levels of sarin nerve gas on animals appear to confirm the theory that some forms of Gulf War illness may have been caused by exposure of U.S. troops to nerve gas. And this was DOD, I think, funded research.
Well, I would actually broaden that claim and state that there's a variety of sources of evidence now to suggest that illness, at least in a substantial fraction of ill Gulf War veterans, is caused by a class of chemicals called acetylcholinesterase inhibitors. Nerve agents are in that class of chemicals, as is pyridostigmine bromide, a nerve agent pretreatment drug that was given to about 250,000 of our troops, and as are two of the major classes of pesticides that were widely used in the Gulf to protect against vector-borne illnesses. Those are carbamate and organophosphate pesticides. The existing epidemiological evidence suggests that people who were exposed to any of these three types of acetylcholinesterase inhibitors are ill at elevated levels. In the case of PB, people who took more pills are likely to be more ill and more likely to be ill than people who took fewer pills. And also there's evidence from animal studies for each of these three classes of acetylcholinesterase inhibitors indicating that low levels of exposure lead to persistent changes in nervous system function.
So it's possible that it's possible they were exposed to low levels of these without showing any immediate effects because they were at low levels, but there would be long-term effects.
That's absolutely correct.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I was going to say, and let me say that additional, particularly persuasive evidence derives from the fact that people who have genetic variations that cause them to be less adept at clearing these chemicals from their body are more likely to be ill. And because their illness status was determined before these genetic tests and also tests for levels of these chemicals were done, it's not possible for factors like media suasion and suggestibility to be responsible for these findings. And it's extremely difficult to interpret those findings in any way other than by by postulating a causal connection mm-hmm. between acetylcholinesterase inhibitor exposure and illness in Gulf War veterans. Again, with acetylcholinesterase inhibitors, including nerve agents, pyridostigmine bromide, and two of the major classes of pesticides.
Well, where would these exposures have occurred? Would the pesticides have been at home when they got home, or would they have been over there in the Gulf?
Pesticide use was quite widespread in the Gulf for noble reasons. In many previous wars, the rate of death from infectious disease was far greater than the rate of death from combat injury, often on the order of 6-1. So in an effort to control vector-borne illness, pesticides were widely used in the campgrounds, around the bedding. People also, in addition, often use personal pesticides. And a separate class of pesticide-type chemical, permethrin, was used to impregnate the uniforms of veterans, although that's not actually the same class of chemical.
Mm-hmm. And there was also news of a bunker called Camisilla. Is that right?
That's correct.
That supposedly had contained nerve gas there.
Right. The Camisilla ammunition depot demolition occurred, in which we, in an effort to demolish warfare capabilities of the Iraqis, demolished a depot in which we only later learned that there was sarin. Actually, evidently, there were some members of our armed forces who had the intelligence that nerve agent might have been there, but somehow that wasn't successfully communicated to the people who were performing the demolition. And several years after the Gulf War, Iraq actually confirmed that sarin had been present in that demolition. And Dr. Kilpatrick can speak to this as well, but the official DOD estimate, which depends on actually what threshold you draw for level of exposure, that suggests that as many as 100,000 individuals may have been exposed to low levels of sarin in that depot demolition.
Dr. Kilpatrick, any reaction?
No, Dr. Ghulam certainly is well aware of the facts. In fact, the Department of Defense did publish a report that outlined several years' work on trying to determine how much sarin, cyclosarin, was present at the time, and with its demolition, where would it have gone, and what would have the hazard area have been, and then worked very hard to determine who were the troops that were possibly in that area. And it took a couple years to really determine where units were located and then who was with units. And that is an effort that certainly with today's deployments, we believe we have done a much better job in knowing and recording where our units are located and retaining that information of where units are located and who is with the units. We used the best science to try to determine what was called the population limit level. In other words, a level of sarin, cyclosarin that a population could be exposed to for 70 years and not have an untoward health effect. That was the lowest level we used. And then anything up higher than that constituted essentially the hazard area. And we've sent letters to some 101,000 Gulf War veterans saying if they were with their unit, because we didn't know exactly who was assigned to which unit, that they were possibly exposed to low levels of sarin on the days of March 10th, 11th, and 12th of 1991.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's see if we can get a phone call in. Aaron in Los Angeles. Hi, Aaron.
I'd like to ask a question to the group that's there. Has there been any good objective studies of the effect of depleted uranium on the soldiers in the Gulf War?
I think the best...
Dr. Kilpatrick, go ahead.
Okay, I'll talk about the clinical study first, because I think that is the most important one. During the Gulf War, unfortunately, we had some friendly fire incidents where people from U.S. military in or on armored vehicles were struck with depleted uranium. Some 112 people survived that incident. We have been following, with the help of Dr. Melissa McDermott at the Baltimore Veterans Affairs Hospital, some 90 of those individuals who agreed to be followed on an annual basis. She has not found in following those group to this date any untoward medical problems that can be related to the depleted uranium exposure. And about some quarter of those individuals still have small fragments of depleted uranium in their body and are excreting high levels of depleted uranium in their urine without any indication of any kidney damage.
Dr. Ghulam, let me get Dr. Ghulam to try. She's in New Zealand, by the way, so please stay with our phone line. Bear with us. Okay. Dr. Ghulam, did you want to react to that?
I just wanted to comment that actually there are two concerns regarding depleted uranium. There's both a heavy metal and a low-level radioactivity concern. And I think Dr. Kilpatrick is fairly representing the existing state of knowledge. A lot of people were exposed, what you might say, casually to depleted uranium by working around the tanks. And then there's the group that were exposed to more high-level depleted uranium through actual body contamination through shrapnel. But there's not substantial epidemiology right now to support a high degree of concern regarding depleted uranium. Of course, with a lot of kinds of things like low-level radioactivity, there may be a time lag of years before certain types of problems like carcinogenic problems, cancer causation, would be evident. So it's important that we continue to do follow-up, but that's not probably one of the highest-level concerns regarding an exposure illness relationship right now.
Dr. Hunt, was that you trying to jump in?
That was me.
I would like to jump in.
Well, we'll give everybody a shot. Let me get Dr. Hunt first. Go ahead.
Yes, actually, Aaron, is Aaron still on the line?
Everybody's there. Oh, Aaron, I think
Aaron.
No, he's gone.
Okay. One thing I want to say, that as a clinician, it's been really nice, for example, with veterans with concerns about depleted uranium, particularly retained shell fragments, and I have one of those individuals in my clinic, Dr. McDermott's program has really created a very nice follow-up system for us, both clinically and as well as research. And the VA, it's similar with the ALS issue now. If there are veterans out there that have ALS, for example, it's really important that they call. There is a registry hotline, 1-877-DIAL-ALS, to get into the system. And if there are GOVETs out there with any concerns about any of these potential exposures and health problems, go to your local VA or go to the website. There's an excellent website, www.va.gov/environagents. That's one word. And all of this information is on that website. So I would encourage veterans to get into your local VAs and use these resources to learn more about these issues.
Steve Hunt? Steve Robinson, Steve. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Right. I don't want to minimize or maximize the importance of DU, but I'll just tell you what we know. The two studies have been produced right now that showed depleted uranium in laboratory animals causes cancer, one from Lawrence Livermore and one from Lovelace. Right now, the World Health Organization is in Iraq, in Kosovo, and in the Balkans, determining the status of depleted uranium that was used in those locations. The European Parliament just 3 weeks ago finalized a resolution in which they're going to make a statement to the United States talking about the fact that if we use depleted uranium in this next war, we may be responsible for the cleanup of that use. I do know that the military is considering moving away from depleted uranium and going to tungsten. There are significant concerns. The scientific studies have not actually come through yet that will either confirm nor deny that depleted uranium is or is not a problem, but further study certainly needs to be done.
Mm. We're talking about Gulf War illnesses this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow, and of course there are lots of questions about what to expect next. And one question I have is the science of what's going to be happening. Are there monitoring stations in the Gulf now set up or people assigned to sample the air, sample the water, sample the soil that the soldiers will be embedded in during the war so that we have a database when we come back? And if there is going to be such samplings, will those samples be available for anyone to take, you know, to study? I mean, the data to study, not just the Department of Defense? Dr. Kilpatrick?
Can I answer that?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry, I jumped in. That's an interesting question. This is Steve Robinson. That's one of the problems we've got with the blood sampling. There were some samples that were taken in the first Gulf War from Marines who had their blood drawn before they deployed and had their blood drawn when they returned. And a researcher who was in the Department of Defense and now works for the Department of Veterans Affairs was given $700,000 to study the blood of these soldiers. And it's my understanding that that study has never been completed. And right now, we really don't know what the status is of it. But the problem is that over the last 12 years, the Department of Defense, being the sole repository of information about what did or did not happen or what samples were taken or where they were sent, hasn't really shared a lot of the information that we'd like for them to share. this blood sampling being one of those things. So I would hope that if there are samples and things that would be brought back, that they would be open to independent scientists. Right now, the person who is the leading, one of the persons who we've identified, Dr. Robert Haley, who is doing fabulous work identifying brain injuries in Gulf War veterans, initially, early on, was prevented from conducting research and doing things and having access. So we would like to see independent researchers also having access to these types of samples.
Dr. Kilpatrick, can you shed any light on this?
I'd really like to address your question, and that has to do with are we doing sampling? And the answer is definitively yes, we are. The Army Center for Health Promotion Preventive Medicine has people far forward with very sophisticated equipment to look at soil, water, air for toxic industrial chemicals, other toxic materials that may be there, as well as looking for any of the other nerve agent, biological agents that may be present in an area. We certainly are very focused on getting that data, getting it archived, being able to have it in a format that we can share it with the VA. When it comes to what do we need to look at as far as people who may be deployed and come back with any kind of symptoms, the Air Force and the Navy also have forward deployed people sampling water and food, making sure that what our people are eating and drinking is safe for consumption. So, and we have people doing vector analysis, making sure that we are using the right level of pesticides to protect our people against vector-borne diseases. So
information
is being collected and archived.
Will the data be available to the public?
Well, there'll be a process on how we do that, and I think when you gather samples, you have a very limited amount of material. So you want to make sure that the veterans come first, and that needs to be the premise of this. And so the Department of Defense, Department of Veterans Affairs will work together to make sure that the appropriate research is done, and whether that research is done within DOD, VA, or external, as over 60% of the current research going on Gulf War veterans' illnesses is external to DOD and VA.
I only have about 30 seconds, so I'm not going to take any other comments, because I will go to a break and we'll come back. I'm also thinking about there are now, I think, 600 embedded journalists that are in with the troops, and I'm wondering what kinds of blood tests they're taking before they go and keeping track of what exposures they've been to, because now civilians will also be exposed to the same thing the troops are, but certainly not in any sort of numbers. We're going to take a short break, as I say, and come back and talk lots more. Take more of your phone calls about Gulf War illnesses, so stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatto, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. A brief program note: with more than 200,000 U.S. military personnel in the Gulf region, who gives the orders? Join Neil Conan on Monday in this hour for a discussion of the U.S. military leadership. We're talking today about Gulf War illnesses with my guest, Michael Kilpatrick, Deputy Director of Deployment Health Support for the Department of Defense; Stephen Robinson, a Gulf War veteran and executive director of the National Gulf War Resource Center; Steve Hunt, a physician and director of the Gulf War Veterans Clinic, Department of Veterans Affairs, Puget Sound Healthcare System in Seattle; and Beatrice Gallome, the scientific director for the Department of Veteran Affairs Research Advisory Committee on Gulf War Illness, and she's also an assistant professor of medicine at UC San Diego. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let's see if we can – we have a lot of veterans on, a lot of Gulf vets on the phone. So let's see if we can go to the phones. Let's go to Phoenix, to Michael in Phoenix. Hi, Michael.
Hello. I'm a Gulf War veteran. I fought with the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment during the war. And for about the past 7 years, I've been suffering from joint problems. I'm on disability with Social Security, but I've been fighting with the VA. One day I may wake up and I can't walk. My ankle's swollen, or my knee is swollen, I can't bend my elbows, and it's just been a long fight. And I go into the VA, and I've been hospitalized like 3-4 times, and they say there's nothing wrong. They tell me, well, you have an infection, you have a high staph count or a high strep count, but they give me no explanations. And I've heard all the stuff you guys have been talking about, you know, for the past 5 years or so, But what I'm wondering is the lower levels down here in the little VAs, like here in Phoenix, why don't they treat us or ask us these questions or screen us to where, you know, what I'm trying to say is they say there's nothing wrong with us.
Mm-hmm. Right, let me get a reaction from a high-level VA guy, Steve, Dr. Hunt. Who, go ahead, Dr. Steve.
Okay. Michael, is it?
Yes.
Yes. One thing is there's no question about your health problem being real or your symptoms or problems being real. And getting that message, I know, is very frustrating and it's incorrect. There, at most VAs, there is a Gulf War Registry physician, and that physician should be particularly knowledgeable about these issues. Also, the VA has created two war-related illness and injury study centers, and sometimes referral to one of those centers, which is also something that would be possible here, might be helpful to you in getting a clear idea of what's going on with your health and what sorts of other interventions might be helpful to you. Also, if you do have undiagnosed symptoms, and I'm not sure if that's part of what you are service-connected for, but I think it's been a great step forward for Gulf War vets that the VA has provided benefits for individuals who have simply symptoms, not simply symptoms, but symptoms without a diagnosis.
And
undiagnosed.
I have gone through the Gulf War Registry.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I receive the newsletter whenever they send it out, but it's like the VA doesn't, it down here, at least in Phoenix, it's, we're not being recognized. They're not taking care of us. And that's the way I feel. I mean, Social Security was a breeze.
Dr. Kilpatrick?
Well, certainly your story, Michael, unfortunately, is one I've heard many times as I've been on the road talking with Gulf War veterans in the last couple of years. We have a number, 1-800-497-6261, where we have people who answer the phones Monday to Friday, 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And while we are Department of Defense, we work very closely with the top levels here in Washington, D.C., with the Department of Veterans Affairs to make sure that we get the right information to the right people in those local VA hospitals. This is a medical issue that was not taught in medical school. So that physicians who have not dealt with Gulf War veterans and their symptoms that cannot be diagnosed with the usual medical diagnostic testing sometimes get frustrated and don't know where to go. And I think doctors like Dr. Hunt and others in the VA certainly can be resources to make sure veterans like yourself get that referral to those centers and those physicians who can provide them care, and we're happy to help do that. The Department of Veterans Affairs has a helpline, which is 1-800-749-8387, and again, that is to try to help people get their issues resolved. And sometimes when you feel like, you know, you keep knocking on the door and nobody's going to answer, letting us get involved to try to help. One other thing I would recommend is that the veteran service organizations, the VFW, the American Legion, Disabled American Veterans, all have service officers who are trained in helping people get through the red tape that it takes to file a disability claim. It's a very complicated process, much like a complicated tax return. And these service organizations, with no charge to the individuals, will help you through that process.
Okay, Michael.
All righty. Hey, what was that other number?
Not the
Department of Veterans Affairs, the other number you gave.
The DOD number is 1-800-497-6261. And all the people that answer the phone are veterans. They're not all Gulf War veterans, but they're all veterans, and they know the frustrations.
All right, Michael.
All right, thank you very much.
Ira, this is Steve Hunt.
Yes, go ahead.
Is it possible I could make a comment
sure.
here, too, just to sort of piggyback on what Dr. Kilpatrick said? We did a project in our clinic looking – actually in our medical center and also Walter Reed, looking at clinicians at Walter Reed to see what doctors thought about Gulf War illness and whether it was a physical illness or whether it was more of a psychological illness. And what we found was that the physical medical doctors, the internists and so on, tended to think that it was more of a mental health concern, and the mental health physicians tended to think that it was more of a physical health concern. And this, like Dr. Kilpatrick was saying, doesn't have to do with doctors not being bright or smart or well-trained or not knowing what they're doing, but these situations that involve medically unexplained symptoms, they don't fit our usual model, and they're very complex, and they're very frustrating to clinicians, and obviously they're particularly frustrating to veterans like Michael, and so we need to do everything we can mm-hmm. to, instead of looking at it as an either-or situation, make sure that veterans get both good physical medical care and follow-up, and also mental health care and follow-up as is indicated.
This is Dr. Glomb, and I'd like to offer the additional comment that there was a lag time between the Gulf War and the onset of health problems in many Gulf War veterans and the time that it really became recognized that there was true illness with physical etiology and symptoms that weren't just psychological or caused by stress. And not all of the physicians at all of the VAs have necessarily caught up with that. In fact, there was a mandatory training program for understanding Gulf War veterans' illnesses several years ago that certainly could have led physicians at veterans health centers to the supposition that there wasn't any concrete cause for these illnesses and that there wasn't any, in some sense, reality to these illnesses. And there hasn't necessarily been any comprehensive training program to update physicians on the more recent evidence.
Mm-hmm. Dr.
Hunt. I'd like to add, too, please.
Oh, go ahead, sure.
We get the calls from the veterans, too, that report all around the country that their doctors, some of them that they report to, don't even know what the myriad of illnesses that Gulf War veterans suffer from. And I think it's important to recognize that the Department of Veterans Affairs, specifically Dr. Leah McKay, recently announced that Gulf War illnesses are real and that they deserve the attention and the proper care that the veteran deserves. And the Department of Veterans Affairs recently funded $20 million to look at further Gulf War illness issues. However, the experience of the last caller is one that we hear often, and so what we need to stress is that the message gets down to the VA and it gets down to the individual clinician, because part of the reason why veterans often hear that your illnesses aren't real is because the doctors at that level aren't aware of the current body of research, or they aren't aware about the emphasis that the Department of Veterans Affairs has put on this issue. They're trying to turn it around, but quite often we get calls from just about every place where veterans still experience this problem, and it shouldn't be. It's something that needs to be addressed.
We're talking about Gulf War illnesses this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Dr. Hunt, let's talk about these about two clinical trials that I understand that the VA has been conducting. What treatments are they were they testing, and why do they decide to try these therapies?
Well, Ira, the reason that we're needing to trial or to have clinical trials is that we're in a situation where individuals have problems and symptoms, and like Michael, they're very significant symptoms that are interfering with their lives. Yet we don't know exactly what the etiologies might be, and so we don't know what treatments to use. The VA has undertaken three clinical trials, one involving the use of doxycycline. There was some suggestive evidence in the private research area that suggested that perhaps there was a mycoplasma, a small organism somewhere. It's smaller than a bacterium, larger than a virus, could be possibly related to some of the Gulf War veteran symptoms, and the doxycycline might help. The VA responded to this. Actually, VA DOD together responded to this by undertaking an antibiotic treatment trial involving 491 vets at 28 VA and DOD sites using doxycycline for an antibiotic, doxycycline, using this for 12 months to see if it helped these symptoms of fatigue, pain, and memory. And that project is currently in the process of being written up. It's not yet published the results, but that will be helpful for us to know whether this specific intervention might be useful. Another intervention that we participated in at my medical center involved using exercise and cognitive behavioral therapy, we found that there's a lot of overlap in the presentation of Gulf War veterans and individuals with conditions like chronic fatigue or fibromyalgia, chemical sensitivities, and so on. And we don't understand these conditions and the etiology of these conditions either, but we know that sometimes exercise and cognitive behavioral therapy, which is a therapy that involves learning ways of adapting to or learning ways of recovering your health in the presence of symptoms, chronic symptoms, not expecting that the symptoms necessarily will go away, but expecting that they will improve enough that you can, your lifestyle will be improved. And you will feel better. So the second project involved looking at exercise and cognitive behavioral therapy. There were over 1,000 veterans involved in this study at 20 VA and DOD centers. And this actually is scheduled to be published on the 19th next week in the Journal of the AMA.
Can you give us a little hint on what's going to happen?
I can't give you a little hint, but I can tell you it will be helpful to us. It will be helpful to us in learning to what extent this type of treatment might be effective.
Right.
And what it reinforces for me is that for many Gulf War veterans, many of the veterans that I take care of, this isn't a situation where there is a problem for which we can find a cure or even a single treatment. These veterans have very complex presentations, as Michael described to us. They have lots of things going on physically. Some of them are perhaps straightforward. Some are less straightforward. This leads to other difficulties related to income, to making your mortgage payments, to keeping your job, to keeping your family and marriage together. And the interventions are our primary intervention. I feel like certainly at our medical center and throughout the VA is to provide as much care and as many resources as we can to assist these veterans in getting their lives back on track and getting to the point where they feel somewhat better and they're able to do better and they're able to perhaps get rehabilitation and job training and that sort of
thing. Steve, I have about 30 seconds. What would you like to see immediately that's not being done?
For Gulf War veterans, we need to get the doctors educated on the environmental exposures that veterans faced. There was a significant loss of time since the Gulf War ended up till now for meaningful research to be conducted. Now it seems that meaningful research is beginning to be conducted, and that's hopeful, but we need to educate the doctors and get the veterans the treatment they need. The other thing is that the veterans are required to meet a burden of proof in which they cannot meet, and that needs to change. A veteran shouldn't have to prove that he became ill as a result of a chemical warfare exposure. He should simply be able to come back home and say, I am ill, and be treated.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Kilpatrick, 15 seconds.
Well, certainly the Department of Defense has learned many lessons from the Gulf War, and force health protection is our strategy to make sure that we are protecting those men and women who go in harm's way.
All right, we've run out of time. I'd like to thank all my guests, especially Dr. Beatrice Gollum, who stayed up in New Zealand on her vacation. She's Scientific Director for the Department of Veterans Affairs Research Advisory Committee on Gulf War Illness, also an Assistant Professor of Medicine at UC San Diego. It's Dr. Stephen Hunt, Director of the Gulf War Veterans Clinic at the Department of Veterans Affairs at Puget Sound Healthcare System. Dr. Michael Kilpatrick, Deputy Director of Deployment Health Service Health Support for the Department of Defense, and Steve Robinson, Gulf War Veteran and Executive Director of the National Gulf War Resource Center. Thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you very much. And if you
missed any of the phone numbers and whatever, Charles will have them up on our website by the end of the day. So please don't be afraid to visit sciencefriday.com. We'll find all the links we talked about today in case you missed any of the things. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flato in New York.